Welcome to Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone. This is a summary and analysis of Trump Card by Dinesh D'Souza. He begins by talking about why immigrants immigrate to the United States, referring to the American dream as being the architect of your own destiny, where you can really make the most out of yourself. It's often mocked that, well, you're born poor and you stay poor and the rich stay rich. This is totally false. The millionaire next door by the New York Times actually did an empirical analysis. About 80% of millionaires are first generation. You also have rags to riches examples of Andrew Carnegie coming from Scotland when he was 12 with nothing, being one of the most successful industrialists ever, drastically lowering the price of steel so the masses had access to something that previously only a few kings and queens had. Steve Jobs coming from a Syrian refugee, more or less, his father. Jeff Bezos is the son of a Cuban immigrant, giving us Amazon, which gave poor people access to products and services they otherwise never would have had access to. My favorite place in Arizona, Los Favoritos Taco Shop, I had to throw in there. And the co-founder of Google was a refugee from the Soviet Union. We also have the average Joe, so it's not just, well, a few people escape out of the depths of American poverty. We actually have data showing us things that are vitally important to life: washer machines, clothes dryer, dishwasher, refrigerators, stoves, microwaves, color TVs, DVD, video cassettes, personal computers, telephones, cell phones, and air conditioners. All households in 1970 versus poor households in 2005. We see that in every case for these major things that are very important to life and allowing us to be fulfilled, live with dignity, we see that in every case, there are more poor people who have access to these products and services today than everyone did on average in the in 1970. Also, a stove today is much better than a stove way back then. This happens as a causal result of competition, voluntary exchange, innovation, voluntary investment, and a number of other things that are unique to free markets and voluntary exchanges. He then goes into how every Democrat on the debate stage raised their hand when asked if they would support, health care for illegal immigrants. This means literally, in theory, 7 billion people could be on the payroll. This is described by Democratic socialists as free. Here is the cost of Bernie's free stuff. That's basically the lie between free: medical care, retirement, infrastructure, college, family leave, pension fund, jobs program. It's not free. I mean, what, do the healthcare workers not get paid? Are they all volunteers? No, what they mean by free is the state coercively funds it. It's literally like saying, well, the military's free, don't worry about it. It's not free. The perfect example is the war on poverty has cost $23 trillion since 1965 under Lyndon B. Johnson's implementation, and that is that's what free means, $23 trillion and never admitting they're wrong, because the poverty rate stopped falling at around that time in 1965. He then, Dinesh, then goes into India is an example of a country that embraced free markets. And they saw a drastic increase. The economic liberalization in India refers to the economic liberalization of the country's economic policies with the goal of making the economy more market and service-oriented and expanding the role of private and foreign investment. Although unsuccessful attempts at liberalizations were made in 1966 and the early 80s, full liberalization was initiated in 1991. Specific changes included reducing import tariffs, deregulating markets, and reducing taxes, all of which led to an increase in foreign investment and high economic growth in the 1990s and 2000s. From 1992 to 2005, foreign investment increased 316.9%, and India's gross domestic product grew from $266 billion in 1991 to $2.3 trillion in 2018. Another case of how embracing much more of a free market approach is China. Well-documented in a book by Ronald Coase, How China Became Capitalist. As Johan Norberg, The Economist, mentions, almost all 250 million jobs created in China's city since 1978, more or less around the fall of Mao's time, were created by private companies. These companies accounted for about a third of exports in 1995, but almost 90% today. This was a move towards free markets in a country. You also have comparable countries with similar populations and similar history. Chile, much more capitalist than Venezuela. Haiti, much less capitalist than the Dominican Republic. North and South Korea speaks for itself. Botswana, much more free market than Zimbabwe. East Germany, much more totalitarian than West Germany. As Milton Friedman says, the record of history is absolutely clear. There is no alternative way so far discovered of improving the lot of the ordinary people that can hold a candle to the productive activities that are unleashed by the free enterprise system. Dinesh continuously makes the case that free markets are superior to state economies. One very important thing that he doesn't really touch on is the difference between political entrepreneurs and market entrepreneurs. Historian Bert Folsom made an important distinction in his book, The Myth of the Robber Barons, between political entrepreneurs and market entrepreneurs. The political entrepreneur succeeds by using the implicit violence of government to cripple his competitors and harm consumers. The market entrepreneur, on the other hand, makes his fortune by providing consumers with products they need at prices they can afford, and maintains and expands his market share by remaining innovative and responsive to consumer demand. The documentary goes on to talk about Marxism, cultural versus economic. This is vitally important. We see this all the time. So originally, the justification for why we need a dictatorship of the proletariat, that the Bolsheviks need to overthrow the Romanovs, or the Tsar, is because the worker is being so mistreated and we have an evil bourgeoisie. That's why we need a big government, because there's such a big injustice. Only a big government can make this right. Well, that didn't really work in America, so what they're doing now is, instead of bourgeoisie versus proletariat, it's black versus white, man versus woman. This is what cultural Marxism more or less is. The cultural Marxist have basically no logical case. I mean, they think that whites are oppressing blacks and minorities. The statistics show that it's not even close as far as black on white crime versus white on black crime. And, you know, when the police kill a black person, it's absolutely terrible. But, I mean, Breonna Taylor gets headline news for months at a time, and Duncan Limp was killed the day before, and no one in his house shot back at the cops, whereas in the Breonna Taylor case, there was shooting back. Of course, you know, her and her boyfriend were totally justified, nonviolent crimes, but this goes to show you that it's a driven agenda that Dinesh does a great job of exposing. We also have Kelly Thomas and Tony Timpa. These people were just killed by the police. The bottom two are on camera, and there were no riots. There was no wall-to-wall media coverage. In 2019, police killed 41 unarmed people. 9 were black, 19 were white. So the idea that it's only happening to one group, or it's disproportionately happening, look, men are 95% of prisoners, and like 95% of those who get shot by the police, not because the police are sexist, because they happen to be going after criminals. He talks about, he shows a great video of this guy robbing a bank, saying, "There's no real principal difference between a socialist dictator taking your money and the socialist majority." I thought that was excellent. Of course, democratic socialism is voting away rights, which is in principle no different. No, I'm coming to rob you on behalf of a different group, not just because I want to. It's the same thing. This democracy, commonly referred to as two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner, it doesn't even recognize the rights of individuals, so it's inherently immoral. Dinesh then goes into the benefits of the entrepreneur, which I thought is a very good case, because Karl Marx originally says that, well, there's just the business who just has the capital that the state just gives him and is in his name, and then they just reap in all the money, as if businesses never go out of business and entrepreneurs lose everything. It's something like 70% of businesses go out of business. So Dinesh lists the benefits of the entrepreneur. He says the vision, an idea of what to sell, how to make the product or service, hiring, organization, where to make the product, where to sell the product or service, how to market the product and sell it to people. They provide the startup capital or the investment. They innovate to stay competitive, and they have a lot of unpaid time investment years before they are profitable, and they have to constantly anticipate the wants and needs. Here is the great quote from the movie. This is capitalism's trump card. It encourages creativity and empathy and puts them at the service of the wants and needs of the people. The inequality the socialist left despises isn't created by the entrepreneur. It's created by us. The proud boast of democratic socialism is that it puts the people in charge of the economy. What control do you have over the post office or the DMV? We vote in elections every 2 or 4 years, but as consumers, we exercise our choices daily through the market. The free market is far more reflective of popular consent than democratic socialism. We don't have to extend democracy from the political to the economic sphere because we already have it. Capitalism, not socialism, is the true form of social justice. Excellent. Probably that's the best part of the movie. He then goes into Blexit, which is a number of blacks leaving the Democratic Party, and the negative rights that Terrence K. Williams mentions in his speech, that people don't owe you anything. You're not entitled to other people's property or other people's time. So this very important to touch on negative rights, to have a foundational understanding of what is a morally justified action and an unjustified action. He then goes into Venezuela. Now, this country is a total disaster. And, you know, now they're saying, well, that doesn't really count as socialism. It's vitally important to know at the time it was totally recognized popularly as this is a socialist revolution. This guy is working for the people, not for the bourgeoisie. Let's all be friends with him. Noam Chomsky, Donald Glover, Oliver Stone, Sean Penn, Michael Moore, constantly celebrating this guy. So now that they're totally distancing themselves and now they're playing the Sweden card, which he also goes into in the documentary, goes to show you that we should try socialism to see if it works, and then if it doesn't, we can go back. By the time you realize it hasn't worked, and it's inherently immoral, so it should never be tried any more than we should give slavery, rape, or kidnapping, or murder, or human trafficking a shot to see if it, quote, works. It's immoral, so we should never try it. But even when it doesn't work out, they just blame something totally irrelevant. So don't count on this, well, yeah, let's give that a shot, and if it doesn't work, well, then we'll have the government vote to drastically shrink the power we gave it after it disarmed us. Because they go into the gun control agenda that took place both in Venezuela and is being promoted in America. He should have mentioned Trump's immoral red flag laws and the bump stock ban, but hey, take what you can get. He then goes into the media double standard. Take this interesting poll with your friends. Ask them if they have ever heard the name Stormy Daniels, and then ask them to briefly tell you what they know about Stormy. And of course, everyone knows about her because she was on The View. She's constantly talked about. Stephen Colbert had her on. Everyone knows her. And then ask them what they think of Larry Sinclair. And this will go to show you that there is a blatant double standard in what we are told by the press. It's important to know that it's not about, I watch the news so I know what happens. All you see when you watch the news is what a group of people want you to focus on, whether it's Fox News or MSNBC or my channel. I only talk about things that I want to bring to your attention. Everyone has a bias, but the power of making sure the bias doesn't control you is simply to know that it exists, embrace it, and try to get competing ideas. So Larry Sinclair, a long time ago while Obama was running for president, claimed that he had an affair and gave a very in-depth analysis. Dinesh actually interviews him again, and he stuck to his story for, you know, 12 years. And he got no media attention, and Stormy got tons. You can also ask people what they think of Kathy O'Brien's story and her book Transformation America. And people will say they have no clue who that is. Look that up for yourself. More or less, she claims that she was assaulted by a specific politician. But everyone knows who Christine Blasey Ford is, and there's just as much proof for both of these incidences. And she's on the cover of Time magazine, and she gets to testify in front of Congress. So, of course, there is a double standard. You can't say, well, if it were true, I'd know about it in the media. The point is not, we know one is true and one is false. The point is that there is selective choice as to what is on our screen and what occupies the mind of the populace. Another example of media double standards and bias is Trump's quid pro quo with Ukraine. This is just something I always assumed happened with foreign aid and all payments to other countries, but if your standard is quid pro quos are bad, we have Joe Biden on tape at the Council on Foreign Relations saying, if the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money. This was a prosecutor who was looking into Joe Biden's son's energy scandal. So, if that is clearly a quid pro quo, this for that, the money for the firing of this man producing the charges. So it's just incredible when you see these double standards. You see the media is just an activist organization. It's not about getting informed or anything. They have a great conversation in a church with this gentleman, a Christian organizer, who says, the one thing that a totalitarian regime cannot allow our citizens to hold an allegiance to one higher than the government. In other words, when your conscience conflicts with Congress or the state, who do you choose? The government needs a monopoly on authority. So they don't want people to believe thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not steal. So when the state tells you to do something, you don't say, well, my parents tell me not to do that. My family tells me this. My friends tell me that. There's the Bible. There's the Quran. There's libertarianism. There's utilitarianism. It's all about the state having total domination over your life. And that's what the anti-Christian, anti-religious agenda is all about, because they are peaceful alternatives to the state's monopoly on authority. Three major criticisms of the movie. He didn't define his term, so it's a little hard for people to know when something is capitalist and when it's socialist. Capitalism is simply a social system based on the explicit recognition of private property and non-aggressive contractual exchanges between private property owners, and in a word, voluntarism. Socialism is the institutionalized interference with or aggression against private property and private property claims, in other words, violence. Another criticism is he should discuss the ultimate check and balance. If you want to be a conservative, conserve the great things in society, we need checks and balances. These are competition, equal rights, and voluntary funding. So if you get bad service at a restaurant, it's important that you're able to go to other places and not give them money when they give you a bad service. Same thing for police forces and military forces and politicians and Congress. If you don't like what you're getting, you should be able to opt out. I mean, if they truly represent you, you shouldn't be forced to fund them. This is gone into much further in a book called The Enterprise of Law, Justice Without the State by Bruce L. Benson. And equality is also important. So it's important that I have the same rights as a police officer, who has the same rights as a politician, who has the same rights as someone who works at Target. Everyone has the equal right of not being aggressed against and the right to self-ownership and private property. This is the full realization that Thomas Jefferson was touching on when he says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Finally, he goes into terrorism and says that Iran hates us and just wants a worldwide caliphate. What he doesn't appreciate is the fact that if you look at bin Laden's own words, his justification for why he hates America is very clear. In 1998, he says, it's the blockade imposed after the ferocious war or the fragmentation and devastation of Iraq. In his 2001 letter, he says, why are we opposing you? He says, why are we opposing you? The answer is very simple, because you attacked us and continue to attack us. He says the same thing to Peter Arnett on CNN in 1997, and to John Miller in 1998. And this, of course, is the United States ambassador to the United Nations on 60 Minutes, more or less justifying half a million children dying, which was what bin Laden was referring to in both of his letters. Bin Laden also mentions the Qana massacre by Israel, and the U.S. is allied with Israel. So just as when the U.S. says Iran is funding terrorists, well, the Muslims say that the source of Israeli funding is America. So we hate them, just like the U.S. hates Iran when they fund terrorists. So we also have three of the alleged 9/11 hijackers constantly referring to their actual reasons, not because, well, there's no Muslims in America and there's no hijabs. Look at their own words, according to Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism by Robert Pape. What is happening in Muslim countries today? Blatant occupation about which there is no doubt there is no duty more obligatory after faith than to repel him. Repelling the Americans occupying the land of the two sanctuaries is the most obligatory of obligations. And I say to America, if it wants its armies and people to be safe, then it must withdraw all of its forces from the Muslim lands and depart from our country. So it's the invasion and occupation of Middle Eastern land that is the blowback that actually causes terrorism. One other thing I wish he would have mentioned is the Fine People hoax, one of the most evil, divisive pieces of nonsense that's constantly pushed. It's pushed by Joe Biden in the first presidential debate and by Kamala Harris in her only vice presidential debate. So this idea is just ridiculous. Trump has Jewish grandchildren. It's the idea that Trump said Nazis and Klansmen are fine people. Of course, never happened. You'd think that Netanyahu wouldn't think so highly of Trump if he was a Nazi. What he actually said was that there are good people on both sides of the statue debate with regard to should statues be torn down in America if the person was racist. So that, of course, is what he's referring to. If you look at the transcript on the right, I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And that's a reality of the situation. Yeah, there's also very good people in BLM, very few. But there's also very few good people in the alt-right. You have to sort of give people the benefit of the doubt when they're in large groups, and everyone is ignorant about politics, not just these people are uniquely bad. So I would say the movie gets an 8 out of 10. It is a net benefit for the freedom movement. It calls the state a thief when it says robbing Peter to pay Paul. It exposes state criminality and corruption. The less confidence people have in the state issuing, you know, being the source of civilization is always good. It explains the monopoly and authority all states seek. It advocates free market capitalism. It exposes Antifa terrorists in the Andy No interview. It correctly shows socialist support of Chavez before the fall of Venezuela. It opposes gun control. It exposes the blatant media double standard in the Stormy vs. Larry Sinclair case. It shows the threat of COVID tyranny and the real popularity of socialism, something I didn't get into, but please watch the documentary. It exposes cultural Marxism and economic Marxism and makes the case for being pro-life. Therefore, I say it is a net benefit to the freedom movement and give it an 8 out of 10. Thank you for watching. Keith Knight, don't tread on anyone.